My name's Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. It is now time for the newcomer app portion of the program. Most of you hopefully have seen this box in the back of the room, along with a stack of 3x5 cards and some pencils. What we encourage you to do is to write down a question about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, something you've been wondering about. Put it in the slot here, and then we'll draw a question at random and attempt to answer it with our panel of experts and also using AA-approved literature. Dolores, are you here? Dolores submitted a question that we are going to have to do some research on and consult some of our female members as well. We just have men here. So we are going to address that question, which is a very good question. Hopefully you can come back next week, and we're going to give you an answer to that. And thank you very much, Dolores, for that question. So, well, I guess you're just going to have to come back here next week to find out now, aren't you? Keep coming back. Anyway, let's see what else is in the box, shall we? Here's a question. I believe that group singing is good for spiritual bonding. Why not sing Happy Birthday to Us, since it is Valley Group's third birthday today? And this one's anonymous. Let's do this as a group. Let's do it together. On three, happy birthday to us. Would you please join me? One, two, and wait a minute. This is a group of alcoholics, okay? So if you can't remember the lyrics to it, just kind of mumble along and you'll see it. All right. One, two, three.
Happy birthday to us.
Perfection. And it is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member of the fellowship since 1997, currently residing in Fresno. He has been the featured speaker for a number of groups, including the recent H&I conference. And so now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, Brian F.
You still about my fighting weight. But that's what AA does. It puts weight on us, right? My name's Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. It's very good to be here. I want to thank Bill for inviting me. I met Bill at the H&I conference. I think it was March or April. And he nailed me down right away. And he has been Johnny on the spot with the emails when I didn't know how to email. He's part of my learning how to handle emails. And it's good to be here. He made it real easy to get here. And I want to welcome, anybody who's relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and congratulations to the chip takers. You know, that's a big deal. And congratulations. Keep coming back, because miracles happen in this program. So I'm relatively new to the area. I came to Fresno about 6.5 months ago, and I do know that we're in Visalia. To the area. I'm actually from the Bay Area, and I came down here from California State Prison at Solano, and so it's really good to be here. it's a little different of AA program, and really beautiful people. There's beautiful people in prison, but you know, you people really shine. I like hanging out with you, and females are great. I love coming to meetings. So it's different for me, and just to get into some of my background with my disease, I do believe in the genetic philosophy of alcoholism, and I believe I had that gene as a kid, and I acted out on it at a very young age. I started drinking. I had my first drink probably when I was 8 years old. And what it did was it made me feel comfortable. It made me feel like there wasn't something wrong with me, because I was picking up messages in my home that, like, I was not good enough. I was somehow broken. I was to keep my mouth shut. I was to not ask questions. I was to pretty much do as I was told. And that was it. And that was confusing for me as a kid. And so I had this self-talk going on at a young age. You guys may have heard the ideas about the alcoholic brain. You know, well, I got that. It's like that hamster wheel that'll take off, left to its own devices. You know, that place in my head is, my sponsor calls it, it's that place that, you know, I'm not allowed to go to without adult supervision, because I can't handle it on my own. And I learned that in AA. So I had this whole self-image, self-esteem thing as a kid. And, you know, my dad was a tough guy. He made sure that I knew he was a tough guy. And by the time I was 14 years old, I left home because I was tired of that tough guy putting his hands on me. You know, a 14-year-old kid, I was done with it, and I went to the streets. And I left my so-called middle-class home and went to the streets. Decided to grow up out there and give it a shot, and was bound and determined to prove to the world I didn't need nobody for nothing, especially my dad. And I viewed the world as a hostile place. You know, it was hostile in my home, and so the world had to be the same way. So I took that attitude to the streets, and it wasn't long before, you know, I had conflicts with law enforcement over violence, you know, fighting kids. And then, you know, when I started packing a knife, it wasn't long before I used a knife, you know. And then, you know, when I started packing guns, it wasn't that long before I used a gun. So it was this escalating pattern of violence, which seemed to grow with my disease. As my alcoholism got fed, so did that aspect of my life, because that's what I brought to the table. So for me, my disease got worse relatively quickly. My alcoholism has manifested in a number of different ways, you know, beyond just alcoholism. You know, I've dabbled in just about everything I could ever get my hands on. And it all took off and got deeper and deeper. So by the time I was, 16, I was headed off to reform school at a juvenile hall. And when I went in, you know, I didn't really feel like I had the problem. I thought the world was the problem. I was blaming my, you know, everybody, my dad, my household, the cops. I wasn't fair. I was a victim. And I went into this reform school and did pretty good for a while, you know, and stayed abstinent. But it wasn't that long before I found ways to get, you know, get a hold of substances in there too. And when I came home out of there, I was 18, and I really wanted to try to stay sober. I thought, hey, man, I'm just not going to drink, you know. I'm not going to do that. Well, you know, I came out of there. I was in Utah, and I came out of there and landed in British Columbia, Vancouver Island. And the drinking age was like 19, and I was 18. So I thought, you know, I can toss it off, you know. And I found my way to a bar and had a drink and stayed there for a while and went back to the motel. And, you know, my dad was in the motel. He was the one who picked me up. And he couldn't tell I had drank either. So I thought, man, that was all right. I handled that. But still, I wanted to not drink. You know, I had that, you know, I didn't know how to do it, but I knew that, you know, it had always caused me trouble. It had helped me to get into trouble. It was part of the problem, maybe not the problem, but part of it. So when I got back home, I went to a party. They had cater parties back then. And, I mean, I guess they still do. I don't know.
The plastic cup.
So I go to a party, and all my old friends are there, you know, and they're handing me those plastic cups, you know, the blue ones and the red ones. And no, I'm not drinking. You know, thanks anyway. No, I'm not drinking. It was fun. You know, there's a lot of people there, that people that I hadn't seen in a couple of years. And I didn't drink. I made it through the whole party and didn't have a drink. I went home and I was like, yeah, I got this, man. And I felt proud. I felt like I had it. And I liked it so much that I went back the next night. You know, those parties back then, I guess they still are today, I don't know, it was a two-day party, Friday, Saturday. So I went back to the exact same house, the exact same cater party, same people the next night, and I had a drink. Because I knew I had the solution, I had to handle it. My willpower was strong enough. And, you know, I was 18 then, and I had a drink. And I didn't stop drinking from that point on. And what happened was, my life got progressively worse very quickly. And I was involved in all kinds of crap in the drug world on the streets in the Bay Area. And by the time I was 21, you know, I was in an escalating pattern of violence. It was bound to get me killed or somebody else killed. I mean, it was bound to happen. I was a train wreck looking for a place to happen. And all along the way, alcohol was part of that. And it got more and more, you know, to where I was drinking in the mornings, drinking at night. It was an uncommon thing for me not to have alcohol around me at some point during the day. So in 1988, I ended up in a situation where I thought that shooting a man would solve my problem. And really what I was looking at was a power thing, a control thing. The same thing that was happening in my household as a little kid, that power and control thing. My dad wanted to control me, showing me that violence meant power, power meant control, and men are supposed to be in control. Well, this just happened to evolve, you know, in the drug and alcohol circles in that town. And I killed a man, and I shot him, and I killed him, and it was a matter of 3 days before the cops arrested me, and I was in the county jail, and during those 3 days, you know, I had nowhere to go, had nowhere to run, had nowhere to get there, had no money to get there, and I was peeking out my curtain waiting for this guy's homeboys to come kill me. You know, that's what I thought was coming. And then the cops came, got me, put me in jail, and I sobered up for probably 2 weeks in the county jail. Now, I don't know if you can even fathom what was going through my mind after, you know, realizing what I had done to someone else's life, what I had done to my life, and how this would impact anybody else. But I was very short-sighted with it. And within a couple of weeks, you know, I was drinking in the county jail and doing other substances. Once the guy showed me how to move that stuff in there, it wasn't long. And I took off, you know, and I went through a whole murder trial, you know, loaded, drunk, loaded on methamphetamine, didn't stop. And the last thing I could do was face what I had made of my life. And they were trying to bury me. So immediately, the world was hostile against me again. Cops arrest me, first thing I said, I didn't kill anybody. He got the wrong guy. You know, first thing, I wasn't copping anything, wasn't taking any responsibility, wasn't having any kind of accountability. And I know there's people in the program in here tonight, you know, and I learned a lot of that in the program too. I just want to throw that out there because, you know, prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about accountability, you know, and this went on for years and years before I got it. And the substance abuse program that I was involved in the pen had a big high level of responsibility and accountability, you know. So I had to really take some inventory and see where I was shortcoming in that area. And lo and behold, I was shortcoming in most of it. So what happened to me was I went through a murder trial lying through my teeth, continuing to act out on my disease, and was convicted of a second-degree murder and sent to California State Prison for a term of 15 years to life for murder and a 2-year enhancement for the gun. So off I went to San Quentin. And I was miserable. I was hopeless. I was full of despair and knew I was going to die in prison. And my disease was right there pushing me forward. I stayed as numb as I could for as long as I could inside the state prison system. And it's easy to do in there. Everything's in there. You know, don't be naive. I know that people have this concept that there's nothing going on in prison as far as all that stuff. It's everywhere. It is everywhere. Everything you can imagine is in there. And I didn't have any trouble numbing myself for years. And I got involved in probably, you know, just about everything you can imagine in prison, because my goal was to be a good convict. And I went up in there to New Folsom to the level fours, knocked back some years, and I was going to die in the pen. So why not? This is what I had made in my life. This is what it was going to be. So I was stepping up to the plate, and I was going to die a good wood. You know, a good convict. That was going to be me. And I did that for years. And what I found was, all throughout that good convict thing was drugs and alcohol. I mean, the disease, looking back now, that's what runs that whole thing. And I was active in all of it. And I spent the first 9 years of my term participating in every bit of it. Trafficking, dealing, staying high, drinking, still learned how to make white lightning. You know, I couldn't believe that stuff actually tastes like gin. I couldn't believe it. And it was very easy for me to stay in that place and feed my disease, especially with my despair and my hopelessness. And so all along I was trying to act like everything was okay and I was in control. It was the same thing from when I was a kid. I was trying to act like it was okay. This is what I made in my life, and it's okay. I'll live with it, the decisions that I made. And you know, that pink can that that Bill had talked about, you know, he mentioned that it's to buy literature for people who can't be here. But what he didn't mention was that it's to buy literature for me. You know, see, I'm a recipient of that can. So the money that went into that can gave me a book inside of prison. It gave me a 12 and 12. And you guys need to know that. Because if H and I wasn't in the pen, I would not be standing here today with you people celebrating your third birthday in this group. If it wasn't for H and I wouldn't be here. And that's the God's honest truth. So just, I want to throw that out there for that can and for anybody who's thinking about getting involved in H and I, and maybe even be thinking that, man, what do I say to those guys or gals? I don't have a story. Just having people come in and making the room available to me. The hand was there when I reached out. And there was all those 9 years that I was in the pen before I reached my hand out, but H&I was there in every joint. Some of them were harder to get to than others, and I didn't care about it, you know, but I know that they were there. But they were there with their hand out to me. And when I was ready, that's the hand that I grabbed. And I started going to meetings in 1995. And I wasn't ready for the program. I wasn't ready to sign up. But in 1997, I was. And a kid who, he was dealing drugs with me, he had actually been going to the meetings with me. And he said, "Hey, Brian, what do you think about, you know, checking this thing out?" And I remember it was on the tier in front of our cell, 218. And I said, "What do you mean checking this thing out?" He goes, "Well, you know, these 12 steps. You know, I've been going to these meetings with you." And that's how I did my time. Whatever yard I was on, I had one partner. And I partnered up with one guy, and we did our time together, and we had each other's back no matter what was going down. And we shared everything, you know, and that's how I did my time at each joint that I was at, each yard I was on. So this was my partner at this point, and, you know, we were involved in everything. And so, you know, he said this, you know, "What about these 12 steps, man? I've been going to these meetings with you." And he's only going to the meetings because he's hanging out with me. He's not an alcoholic either, you know. So I said, you mean to tell me that, you know, you want to? And I said, "Man, you know, and for me, forgive me, I know this is AA, but, you know, it was like, I told him, if you're asking me to tell you I'm never going to do another shot of heroin, I'm not going to tell you that, man, because my word means something to me. Because I'm a down convict, right? My word's got to be solid." And he was hurt. he was like, you know, embarrassed. He was younger than I was, and, you know, I was older, and he looked up to me a little bit. And I went away and thought about it for 3 days. And what happened was, I came up with, I'm a T-chart kind of guy. I like to put the positives and the negatives, you know, the assets, liabilities, the risk factors. So the worst thing I could come up with was that I would fuck off my high for a few months while I proved AA didn't work. That was the worst case scenario. I'd shelf everything, and I'd be the guy who proved AA didn't work. The best case scenario was that the program would work, and I could start looking like the other lifers in the room who looked good. They were sober, and they were friends of mine. Two of them in particular that I had done level four time with, and this time I was at level three. And they had something. They had what you people have. You know that glow, that look. We look good in recovery. We shine. We clean up good. Well, they had that, and I thought, man, maybe I could get that. And you know what else, maybe? Maybe I could quit being a hypocrite. Because my sister had this beautiful baby girl, and she asked me to be the godfather to this kid. And I was devastated. I was so taken back because what do I have to offer this brand new baby? I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I'm an alcoholic, drug addict. I'm everything. I'm a convicted murderer. What do I have spiritually to offer this kid? And that floored me. It was like getting punched. You know, I took it, you know. Nothing again. I didn't flip the punch. I caught one on the chin right there. So I thought maybe, just maybe, if this thing actually worked, if that's what I would get. And what I had to do was I had to go all in. You see, I knew. I'm kind of like an all-in or all-out guy. I know that if I don't come all in, then it's me who's full of shit again if it doesn't work. You know? It's me. I knew it would come back on me, and it's come back on me my whole life. I'm the one who didn't step up. It was me. And I knew enough to know that. So I had to go 100% in. So on November 9th, 1997... I did that. I stepped in, and I asked Steve to be my sponsor. Steve was a lifer who had done time with me when I first went into the prison system, and Steve was so happy that I was getting on board. He was so happy. He loved me. He embraced me. He guided me. He supported me. That guy showed me how to work the steps. He worked the steps with me, and Steve's still in prison. He's a lifer who's still in there. And he, I gotta give that guy credit, man, because he was a hell of a sponsor. And that's how I started working it. And what I did was, I followed directions. Not an easy thing for a guy like me. He knew how to handle it, you know. And he loved me, and he supported me, and he made me feel like it was okay. And I did the best that I could, and he would always tell me that. Now, you ain't gotta do it perfect. Just do the best you can. And I'd bring it to him and he'd say, yeah, that's good, but why don't you try it again? Again? You know, I did that a few times with Steve. And he used to make me write a lot, you know. And what I found in prison was that writing was a huge part of my recovery. And I journaled. And I still journal today, not like I used to, but I have journals that are fat and filled with my early days of recovery. Journaling was a huge part of my recovery for me. And so what happened was I started working the steps, and things started changing. There was a period where I was very angry. I went through a period where I was fighting. I was like a year and a half into sobriety, and I had a whole lot of anger. And I was fighting with my cellies. And one day I was in a meeting, and there was a lady, you know, they have these H&I people come in, and she had told me, her name was Patricia, and she had told me, Brian, if you work these steps, you're going to feel better, you know. She was always, you know, trying to bring the word and encourage me, right? And I remembered that, and I was pissed off one night in the meeting. On Tuesday nights we had meetings. And I'm venting on the whole room. I mean, we sit in a circle, and I'm spewing. I'm puking on everybody. That's what I do as an alcoholic. I puke on people. You know, I want you to feel my anger, my confusion, my anyway. So I puke, and I'm puking, and I'm saying, this damn book, and this guy this, and this ain't working for me, and this program's full of crap, and you know what? I don't understand you people, you know, and I start doing the you are different than I think. And she's over there laughing away, man, and we're in a circle, so I can see her laughing, you know. I'm serious, you know? And we're in prison. You're supposed to be serious in prison, you know? And this shit ain't funny. And she's laughing. And I blasted her. I crosstalked. And I said, you know what? And you told me. You told me I'd feel better. And she's laughing. And she goes, yeah, Brian, you feel better. You feel anger better. You feel hurt better. You feel frustration better. You know, scared better. And I laughed because she's right. See, what was happening through Alcoholics Anonymous was I was beginning to feel things. And that's what was lacking. And I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to handle my feelings. See, I had been trained since a kid to stuff all that stuff, and men don't cry, and you don't talk about these and that, and you don't be confused, you make a decision and live with it. You know, all that stuff at the man box we get fed, you know, I had that. And AA taught me how to maneuver through that. So things started changing when I was able to start laughing at myself in AA. And I've learned that, how to laugh in AA. I learned how to smile in AA. I got a slew of pictures, man, from the yard. And they're hard, man. I went in and I was, you know, when we take pictures in there, I never smiled. I can't stop smiling now. Every time we take a picture, I'm a cheat, you know, I'm cheating, man. I really like to laugh and smile, and AA taught me that. So when I came into AA, I got sober because I thought I was going to die in prison. You see, no lifers were getting out. I was a lifer. They treated us differently, you know. We weren't getting out of the pen. Back then, in 1997, I didn't know a single lifer that had ever gotten out of the joint. I had good, solid evidence to believe that I was going to die in prison. I had everything that I had experienced those first 9 years told me I wasn't going to get out. So I believed I was going to die in there. And what I wanted to do was die differently than the way I was watching other guys die. I wanted something different. That's what I really wanted. So when I started working this program, you know, going to any length, I was willing to. And what happened was, AA taught me how to start living. And I'll be damned, man, if the prison didn't change. I mean, it didn't really change. I changed, right? But that's what I felt like. I mean, the same drama was happening, but, you know, my glasses were different. You know, I was able to see things differently, and I was able to see that it was my attitude. And it was like me that was the problem. And I could choose what I put that hamster wheel, you know, on, what I put in there. And so I have that alcoholic brain that does that squirrely thing. And it's my thinking. And I can choose my misery. I heard a guy say one time in there, he said, you know, pain is inevitable, misery is an option. You know? And I had chosen misery. And what happened was, the consequences of my life history, the history is what it is. The consequence was that I built a prison in my mind that was stronger than any prison California could make. And we got some damn good contractors out here. They're tough, man. They make some high-power penitentiaries in California. And the prison in my mind was stronger than anyone California had to offer me. And when I got that through AA, I learned how to be free inside the joint. And I started getting involved in community. You know what that means? Service, right? In AA, we call it service work, getting busy with other people, right? Helping other people out, genuinely caring. We learn how to love. I learned how to love in AA. And you know what else I learned? That I'm not an angry, hostile human being. I'm a loving, spiritual creature that my God created. And so are you. And you know what my natural state is? It's to love you. That's what AA taught me. My natural state to be in is love. And I always thought it was alcohol would make me feel that. And it would fill that void. Or women would fill that void. Or money would fill that void. Or violence would fill that void. And I'm never satisfied. I got that human condition that I'm never satisfied. I walk down the street, find a $5 bill, and I ain't happy. I'm happy for about a half a block. But immediately, I'm looking the rest, another 2 miles, like this. I'm looking for another 5, or 10, or the damn wallet the guy drops. You know what I mean? Because it doesn't satisfy me. And the only thing that satisfies me is that connection with my higher power. That's what I learned in AA. And when I have that connection, I'm not capable of hurting people. It's just not who I am. You see, I truly have that spiritual malady. You know, and When I have that connection, it's a solution for me. So my message to you people today is that it's a spiritual solution. And when we get grounded in truly being happy, joyous, and free, we have a connection with God. When you feel joy, it ain't over getting things. It's not over a present, not over the new car. That only lasts for a little while. But it's that connection of loving somebody, helping somebody. That feeling of helping somebody out, helping your fellow human being, of building community, being part of something. Instead of always thinking I'm different. You know, I always thought I was different, that I didn't fit. And I fit. You know, you are my favorite people to hang out with. You know why I hang out with alcoholics? Because you get it. You get it at a level that normies don't. And when I say that, I mean, I just spent a week, 2 days up in Elgin. You know, I woke up near Placerville this morning. I watched the sun come up in the mountains in Placerville. And I'm up there with friends of mine, and they don't get it the way you people get it. You know? And that is the most beautiful thing to me, because I know where to come to connect. And I can be all the way up there in the mountains after being out of the pen just 6 months. I did 22 years and 3 months in there. I'm 43 years old. That's half my life. And I can be up there in the mountains watching the sunrise, and it's good. It feeds my soul like it feeds your soul. And they just go on about their business. They ain't even paying attention to it. They don't get it. You see, God's painting me a picture. And that's what I do. It's for me. He's painting me a picture. He's talking to me right there. And that's the connection. I learned that in AA. Miracles happen. When I got free inside the joint, they couldn't hold me no more. I went through 7 parole consideration hearings. On the 6th one, they found me suitable. They said, Mr. Fowley, you are not a threat, and we support you in your release. We believe you're going to be a successful human being. Good luck to you. And Arnold Schwarzenegger reversed that decision the day before I was to go home. And it wasn't about me. He was doing that to like 95% of the guys going. So it wasn't personal. You know, I might have faltered just a bit, but I was back on my toes, you know, and I had to do the dance for another year. And what happened was they agreed again. I had to go back, and they said, yeah, he's wrong. He is wrong, and this is why he's wrong. And we support you in your release. And Jerry Brown had been in office for like a month. He signed the papers, man. Thank God for Jerry Brown, man. I'm out here, you know. And I walked out of there, hey, happy, joyous, and free. And you know what I know? I came out here and did 90 and 90. Because that's what the program told me I may need. I was scared to make the commitment, because I'm a man of my word. You know that whole story, right? Fuck, can I do 90 and 90? What if something happens? Then I'm a failure, you know? What if I get caught up over here? You know, I had all the excuses. But I did it, and what started as 90 and 90 turned out to be like 150 and 90. I mean, I got busy. I wasn't working. I had time. Fresno Fellowship was off the hook. Them guys just sweeped me up, man. It was like loving, embracing arms, people picking me up. I had to get a permit. I didn't even have a driver's license. I'm not even in a computer when I came out. I didn't have any information on me. I had to start from scratch. I show up to the driving test with my stepdaughter, who was then 18. And I'm in the driver's seat. I'm going to take my job. Dude comes up. He's all, well, I guess we're here for her. I'm all, well, no. It's for me. He's all, come on, you don't have a license? No. Well, you've been out of state? Nope. And I didn't explain myself either. Hey, but he did not expect that. I had to go get a permit and then, you know, drive and take a test. So it was all starting over. But those guys picked me up and took me to meetings all over the place. And, AA is a wonderful experience for me, and I want to say that miracles happen. I didn't get sober to get out of the joint. I already told you why I got sober. The doors open when we live a right life. And when I say right, I'm saying a spiritual life, a connected life. And I don't know what's to come next, but I'm saying yes to everything. You know, somebody asked me to come speak somewhere, I'm going to speak. Because I feel like I have a duty. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And that's no joke. You know, half of it was in the pen. I mean, look what I went through and what I did with my life and to other people's lives. You know, it was obvious I was powerless over alcohol. And my life was unmanageable. It was obvious. So my solution to my life was Alcoholics Anonymous. And don't leave. I heard people say this, so I'm just saying what other people have said. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Give yourself a break. Hang out, keep coming back, and let us love you until you love yourself and you love others, because that's who you're meant to be. And you pass it on, and you love somebody, and you make somebody feel good. It's so easy to lift people up out here. I can't believe it. I mean, all you got to do is say hi. Most people don't even want to look you in the eyes as you walk down the street out here. That tripped me out. People don't make eye contact. But when I say good morning, oh, good morning. You know, but it's that momentary, what's he want? You know? I'm like, damn. Like that? But it's so easy to pick people up instead of push people down. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We pick people up. We pick each other up, and we carry each other. I also heard somebody say, we don't shoot our wounded. You know? You are welcome here. And I welcome you, and I tell you what, I really appreciate the welcome I got here tonight, and I love you people. I love you. Thank you.
That's a birthday party, eh?